warn our friend with the tape. Again, to repeat for the tape, I'm Marge Wold.
I'm Erling Wold.
And this is the second of our talks on change. Last night, we talked about personal change and how it affects relationships. And now we're talking about change in a couple relationship. And again, I apologize to single people that we're dealing so heavily right now with husband-wife relationships, and realizing that for every married couple in the United States, there is one single person. And if you think about that, and our heavy emphasis upon family in the church, we sense that we're neglecting a great proportion of our population. But again, when change occurs in the microcosm, it's probably a paradigm of the macrocosm or a model. And so we figure that what happened to us and the kinds of changes that occurred in our life in a kind of dramatic, very dramatic and sudden way, is also a kind of a telescoped experience of that which most of us experience in a developmental way through life. We know that we go through various transitions in our lifetime, and as Gail Sheehy calls it, passages, so that we're changing constantly. And if we're going to remain intimates through a lifetime, whether it's as married couples, as friends, whatever, we have to be aware of change and keep relationships up to date. Last night, I kind of left you hanging a lot. I realized that you went away from here with a lot of questions, a lot of unresolved feelings, and I didn't do much to help. But in a sense, one of the things I believe in strongly is that it's only as we struggle with the questions that we arrive at answers that are helpful to us. For me to give you a lot of pat answers would not have been helpful to you at all. You still have to deal with your own feelings, your own relationships, your own ways of coping and coming to terms with change in your own life. I like the statement that Corita Kent has modified from Nietzsche, who said, "Chaos trusted becomes a dancing star." And she said, "You must carry a chaos within you to give birth to a dancing star." And I believe in chaos as a good theological matrix for creativity, no matter what that creativity is. So just as in the beginning, the earth was without form and void, and the Spirit of God brooded on the face of the waters, so we have to go through periods of voidness and chaos and times when there is no form to our life to finally have the experience of let there be light and give birth to creation. So that, I hope, was the beginning, or at least a worthwhile experience for you last night, to leave here with some of that chaos within you, and that maybe some of you have given birth to dancing stars in the process. But tonight, Erling and I are going to talk about the dramatic change that came into our life, or the dramatic experience that precipitated a lot of changes, which we maybe had been working at slowly in our lifetime, but suddenly there was no doubt about it. We had to face the fact that life for us had changed. As I mentioned last night, that experience took place for us at 3:30 in the afternoon, August 10th, 1972. We had just started a vacation at Laguna Beach, 3 days into the vacation, beautiful area of the country. Any of you who have ever been there know that there is no more beautiful stretch of coastline than that South Bay stretch that runs through Orange County and the kind of the pearl in the middle of it is Laguna Beach. And we were at El Morro Bay. We had a trailer home in the bay, and we liked to go there occasionally. We didn't own a home of our own, and so that became our place. We were there. We loved body surfing. We've lived in California. We had lived since 1953, except for a brief time in Grand Forks, North Dakota. And we loved body surfing. So we were accustomed to it. We knew the ocean. We loved the ocean. And Erling often felt that he had seawater in his veins. But that afternoon, I was on the beach sunning myself, sitting with a friend, and Erling was down in the water. And all of a sudden, I became aware that in that sunlit afternoon, with the sun glinting off the waves, that the waves were breaking a little more fiercely on the beach. And I saw them hitting higher up on Abalone Point, which was kind of a measure of the height of the waves. And then as I got up with kind of an apprehension in my mind, I noticed that down in the water, our daughter, college-age daughter, who was swimming also with Erling, and our 14-year-old son were suddenly focused in on something that was going on, and I knew something had happened to Erling, and I saw my daughter gesturing with her hand, and although I couldn't hear her above the roar of the waves, I knew that she was screaming for help. So I ran down into the water, and there she had her arm under Erling's body, and I looked at him. He was turning blue. The top of his head was scraped off. The upper teeth, all the enamel had been knocked off by the force of his lower jaw hitting the upper jaw when his head hit the bottom of the ocean and he flipped over. And he just whispered to me, "I'm numb all over."
I guess this is my 9th anniversary, plus one day. Because I was dead and am alive, I think without any question. I broke my 3rd, 4th, 5th neck vertebrae. My neurosurgeon said, when Marge asked him weeks after I was hospitalized, "Is my husband doing well?" And he asked, "What do you mean, Mrs. Wolt? Is he doing as well as he ought?" And this man with 14 years of postgraduate study simply said, "My dear Mrs. Wold, your husband shouldn't be." He used to come and see me at 1:30 in the night, click his teeth, when I was hardly able to breathe. And I thought, is this idiot my surgeon? He couldn't believe I was breathing. So I had a water baptism, and in the profoundest sense, a new birth. When I came to, apparently minutes after I broke my neck, with my head, hands, and feet under the surface of the sea, descended downwards, I saw this piercing light at my right, brighter than the noonday sun. And I suddenly recognized the presence. I'll never forget, of course, that's the most vivid experience, I suppose, of my whole existence. I said, "Lord Jesus, this is homecoming I waited for all my life. My whole existence prepared for this awesome moment. If the party is about to begin, if the orchestra's going to start playing, if you got your apron on and are going to serve me," I said. And I thought of all those things. They can happen, you know, across 10,000 valleys of your mind in one split second. You can have concurrent thoughts. It happened to me when I was a kid. Everything I'd ever said, done in one split second. 50,000 ideas. I said, "If this is homecoming, bring me home." And I tried to swim toward that light, the source of it, the cascading light, and then I recognized I was paralyzed, I couldn't move. A friend of mine at seminary had a father who was a pastor, who one day as professor at a Bible school asked God, "Give me a ministry of suffering." And in 4 days he got polio, never got out of a wheelchair. I thought of that, and I said, "If you want me a quadriplegic, I'll be happy. I love my ministry. I love my wife, my family." I said, "Lord, if you resurrect me, I'll do my best to be a minister." Those three things came in sort of a prayer relinquishment. And the moment I made that last petition, my daughter turned me over and screamed for help.
Erlinger and I are just kind of feeling our way tonight, but we, in that moment, probably the most profound thing that happened was a sudden reversal of roles. We had almost been married 30 years at that time, which you can figure out means that we're going to have our 39th anniversary this year.
Wow.
But we had been married 30 years almost.
I mean, wow.
And now you disturbed me.
I'm sorry.
I didn't know where I am.
I'm sorry.
Flustered.
No, I'll tell you what.
No.
We've been married
30 years. And I pretty much, well, I had stayed home. We have 5 children. I had done a lot of volunteer work. I had started about 15 day nurseries and had directed 3 of them, but always as a volunteer, because we come from that old school where the wife doesn't take for her services in the church. And so I'd been a volunteer, very traditional. We started out our life with all the injunctions that both sets of parents had laid on us about the role of a wife and a husband. And so I had been told by my mother exactly what my responsibilities as a pastor's wife was. And Erling and I had been, we found ourselves liking to do different things in the home. I never did like housework, mainly because I was the oldest daughter in a family of 8 children and always was forced to do it every Saturday. And so I just developed a distaste for it. It didn't thrill me to see anything shine. And but Erling had, because his mother was a semi-invalid, had been praised and stroked for the fact that he, as a middle child, was the one who was always helping mother. And so he knew how to wash clothes. He loved to wash the floor. He's compulsive about windows and likes things to shine. But there we were, married, and we had to fight this background because we were part of our culture that said it wasn't right for me to feel that way, and it certainly wasn't right for him to like those things, much less do them. So when we went to Fort Worth, Texas, and started this new congregation, if Erling were down scrubbing the floors, as he usually was and I wasn't, if anybody knocked at the door, he quickly got up, dried his hands, ran to the study, and I got down on my hands and knees and scrubbed the floor. And if I were in the study helping him with his sermon text on Saturday, because I had a major in Greek from Luther College and New Testament Greek especially. In fact, my classmate there was Jack Price of the Missouri Synod, Jack Price, and we were the only 2 students in the upper level Greek classes. So we used to love to sit and read Greek together. But if anybody came, I quick ran over to the typewriter and pretended I was typing his sermon, and he let it go at that. We were just that role-oriented and that traditionally brainwashed. So here we were, and the doctor told me that my husband would never walk or work again, and that I would have to be the family breadwinner.
It's tough for a male to be helpless. I've been very vigorous, very mobile. I was a tennis player. Ran 2 miles at least every morning, lifted weights, had worked as a kid. If any of you know what it means to unload 33 tons of coal by hand in one day, you understand what I mean. I'd never been sick, and all of a sudden, all my energies drained from my fingers and from my toes. I was paralyzed. If you want to feel what that is like, lie down sometime and don't move for an hour. when you itch or want to move, or lie down for a day and be immobilized. You'll sense something of the horror of what it means to be completely without strength. When St. Paul says in Romans that we are all without strength, he meant emotionally and responsibly toward God. But to be totally paralyzed, all your energy drained. Number two, I discovered again in a deeper sense what it means to be a male. I was kind of stereotyped that a man has two measures to his achievement. One, that he's the main provider for funds for the family, main means of support. And secondly, that he's physically potent. A male has to be virile. And I was without work for really 12 months when I recovered. And I was impotent for months with a possibility of never being virile again. And when those images that are really your stereotype of a maleness, it can really be destructive. I got new insights into what a woman is, particularly my wife. I was stereotyped. I read that Old Testament King James passage that God made a helpmate for man, and always thought that meant something just a little bit less. That's a bad word, horrible translation. The word in the Hebrew, azer, means energizer, power pack, power motive. Later. It has nothing to do with second-rateness. I read the Old Testament again. It says that God made a human being, comma, male and female. And then I discovered that both of them were totally equal. Both came with the same capacity, same quality of God. And to both he gave the mandate, caress the earth and make it bubble up and become creative. And then I began to read the New Testament with new eyes. I saw that Jesus, for example, never put down any human being. And the ones who responded to him, I, even from my maleness, now say 10 times more effectively than men in the gospel. They read him in seconds. The woman at the well dug Jesus in minutes, which his male disciples didn't catch till after the ascension. That's my reading. And when it says that we argue who's head of the home, when you read about Jesus, head of the church, you discover that he was its servant. And he said, if you want to be chief, become the chief slave. And when he says to women, you should be responsive to your husbands, he said, be responsive to each other out of reverence for Christ. That's the mandate. But in a world where women were given to men, he said, you better respond to him. But then you men, love your wives like Christ loved the church, and he gave his body and life for her. Men have 10 times more awesome a responsibility than women, if you read the New Testament. I got humbled, and I saw life through new eyes. I rediscovered, as Marge said, something about housework. Because those 7 months I lived in Minneapolis when she was executive director of women's work for our national church, I had to do the housework. I had no car. I could hardly walk. I paralyzed again completely one day when I was exercising. And that was kind of frightening. So I discovered a lot of it can be terribly boring if it's the only diet you've got. And if you have no kids, that can excite you a bit more. I think my son, our son, Stephen, he's a pastor in the celestial city of Aberdeen, South Dakota. Stephen and his wife took, as pastors, a 3/4 time call each. And both spend as much time with Brother Benjamin, 2.5. They each give equal time to their kids. He gets as much male image as he does female image. I think that's very biblical. I really do. And then I discovered again that women are often expected to take care of extended family. I was the one, at home with Marge's mother. Now she's with us again. She's 86 and a half, going on 100. And Marge travels 65% of the time. Guess who's with her mother? Guess who hears the same question 10 times per hour? What time is she coming? And she promptly forgets. It can drive you through the wall, right into paradise. I like that statement, you know, in the Roman letter about tensions like these produce patience. I learned just a little bit of it.
You were a patient.
I was a patient. I'm going to stop there.
Okay. Well, the change in my life gave me a great appreciation for what a lot of women in our society go through. I once again was reminded of my own smugness for many, many years. Part of my role conviction as a younger mother and wife was that no mother should ever go to work outside the home. And I smugly reiterated that in Bible classes and women's study groups for years. And I have lived to wish I could take back some of those words. But I've had to be chastened by the Lord to deal with that, what I call just smugness when I said that. Because I had started to have insights into the problems of many women when I directed day nurseries, of course. And that's when I began to be concerned about equal pay for equal work. Mm-hmm. When I saw mothers as single parents caring for 2, 3, 4 children with salaries that could never match the salary of a man and yet having to pay the same rent, the same prices at the grocery stores, the same fuel bills. And I began to have a lot of feminist stirrings. But I always pushed that down as kind of something apart from me. We don't usually get terribly excited about anything until it comes home to us. And now it came home to me that I, as a woman in my 50s, had to go out and find employment to support 2 children in college and 1 in junior high.
And 1 child at home.
Yes.
Me.
And what do you do if you have a college major in Greek and Bible and a master's in biblical theology and you have taken postgraduate work in early childhood education and marriage, family, and child counseling, but never got a degree in any of them? And so you have the kind of smattering of education that a lot of women have in our culture. And besides that, you were scared to death of getting out in the world. And the world was terrifying to me. I had done traveling and speaking. I'd been on the national board of American Lutheran Church Women. But I had never been out there in what I assumed was that sophisticated world of work where everybody was smart, brilliant, attractive, and knew just how to get along. And I wonder if men realized, I know Erling never did, realize how many things men take for granted about that workaday world that women never, ever have to deal with. I had never even bought a plane ticket for myself before. I had never rented a car before or driven alone in a strange city. And yet suddenly I had a job. By the grace of God, I didn't have to go to the May Company or Sears Roebuck and apply and find a job that would pay me minimum wages and live on that. But I got a job, the only job probably for which I was qualified at the time, and it was a good job, but it really just hit me very hard at the point of agoraphobia, which afflicts most women who have been at home for many, many years. The symbolic carrying a woman over the threshold on her bridal night is almost guarantees that somebody's going to have to carry her over the threshold the other way if she ever has to get out of that house, because she's carried in there, she's put in there. The door, in a sense, really locks behind her if she's a woman of my age and my indoctrination into the cultural role. And there you stay with your children, and there you keep house, and you have your little domain. But the world outside is something you only get secondhand and through news articles. And so when you're out there alone, it's very, very frightening. And I began to appreciate all the women who are widows, who are divorced in middle years when they've given a lifetime of devotion to a man, and they have no source of income, they cannot earn a decent living, and there they are, stranded in a frightening world. So the role reversal was a very painful process for me. And I think we have to understand that when crisis hits one member of a family, if we believe in the family systems model, it hits and affects all of us.
I certainly got a new perception of what it means to be a father. I'd been raised with the idea that the choice is foist. And I put that number one. We started the mission in Texas. We were the first one in the old Norwegian Lutheran Church. So through a dint of a lot of energy, we got the magnificent sum of $5,000 in loans to start a new parish. And I worked 18 hours a day to get that thing off the ground, because that was to be a pearl in the necklace of the church for its future. We went off to graduate school after 6 years, and to support the family, I began a mission, and then later worked in another church. And both of us went to graduate school for 24 months, but I worked weekends and tried my best to do both, again, to the neglect of my family. I was called to a college professorship. I was to be director of public services for 3 years, and the former president of Pacific Lutheran University, who was on the faculty, was to retire. I was to replace him. I was there about 2 months when he had a stroke and died. I got his job plus mine. We couldn't get a house in Decorah, so we also served a parish baroque. We were there 3 years. I worked 18 hours a day, 7 days a week. Enjoyed it immensely. Went off to work, got a call to North Hollywood. The church grew to a staff of 76 the 12 years we were there, and we had a membership of around 3,600. It was fascinating. I traveled the world. I flew with the Air Force. I spoke everywhere. It was magnificent, fun, exciting. I can recall taking three of my kids to the hospital for tonsillectomies, for example, and leaving them and returning when I was through with my little clam bake to pick them up and take them home. When I think back of the horror of it, I'm appalled. When I lay hospitalized and couldn't move, couldn't put my arms around my wife or my kids, it was kind of an awesome experience to realize that all those years that had gone by, I put the church first, but that isn't even biblical. I took our first two sons fishing once when two members of our parish, one the assistant to the bishop, coerced me. Can you imagine anything so horrible? So I learned again. In all my years, no one ever gave me a model. My father was a workaholic. He liked it when I worked, so I worked. He smiled his approval. And that's what I gave my life to. And it's tragic looking back. Luckily, Marge was a magnificent mother, and together we managed to do fairly well, but it was by the grace of God.
But that magnificent mother was seething underneath, because I didn't like it, and I resented the fact that Erling used the church as an excuse and his dedication to the Lord as an excuse to what I felt was to neglect the children and to neglect his home. And it made me, for many years, doubt his love. And I used to feel about number four on his list of priorities. You know, the church, the people of the church always came first. There was always a sermon in preparation, and the typewriter was his companion then, and the car, because he was always out visiting. And then somewhere down number four came me and the children. And so I lived with that, and yet never said much about it, because I had been trained to think that this is what wives were supposed to do. They were supposed to stay home and take care of the children and provide support and affirmation for their husbands. And when Erling never said no to any assignment that came to him, and went overseas as a civilian chaplain in the Air Force, and every time they asked him to, which involved trips to Japan, Okinawa, the Philippines, Alaska, wherever they asked him, and I was left home to take care of the children, a lot of resentment built up. And yet it was difficult for us to talk about that, because the emotions then would run so deep, and we did not know how to really express our feelings to each other without fighting destructively. Erling especially had difficulty handling confrontation and handling anything that he called negative. I came from an unchurched home with a Roman Catholic father and a Protestant mother, and while we were not, we were not people without faith, because I certainly got respect for God and for the church from my parents, and saw my father, especially his devotion to his prayers and to Mass. Nevertheless, we were a very earthy family. My father was a truck driver in the city of Chicago, and we danced and we played cards at home, and my father smoked and he drank beer. And then I married this man who came from Mattock, North Dakota, and where you never danced. Erling piously would take his cousins to the dance hall and park outside and just listen to the music, because he wouldn't go in. And they never played cards. That was of the devil. And they only drank out in the granary where nobody could see them. And so right away, we had some differences in our outlook on life. And I suppose that I felt that a lot of fun had gone out of life. But I loved Erling Wold, and I loved him very deeply, and was committed to our marriage and committed to intimacy, and longed for the day when we could open up to each other and share our feelings with one another.
It was a strange thing, you know. I'd asked the Lord before I broke my neck for an awakening. The parish we had before I broke my neck had 5,500 members. The other had 3,600. And I got caught and lost in the gears. And it was strange how the Lord answered. Very strange. But I felt that I had a number of emotional prisons. And maybe I broke out of a few of them. One was I had never wept that I can recall in my life. My father didn't weep. There was no emotions visible except his smile of approval, and I always made him like me. And that's, I suppose, the drive of most all of us when we're kids. But I never knew that he wept. I never knew how he felt. He never explained that. There was no visible sign of emotion twixt my mother and he. And those things I didn't notice so much till I was much older, looking back across the years. So it wasn't until I broke my neck that I wept. Sometimes I wept all night long, but for sheer joy, when I began to pray for the first time all night like Jesus. I talked about it. It's a biblical fact. I had never practiced it. And the Lord gave me names all night long. So I learned how to weep. I can still weep. I hurt. I feel like I've been just overhauled by Muhammad Ali in his prime. And I got to live through it. And sometimes it builds up like a prison. My chest feels like it's compressed with malevolent hands. And so I weep occasionally, not too often, once every 2-3 months, and it releases it. So tears are a marvelous way of expressing the fact that you're human. And many men are taught that they ought not, and that's kind of tragic. Secondly, I hope, rid of a few easy platitudes. You know, so easy. My daughter said sometimes in the past when she was young, that when she would tell me something, I'd say, well, Lord, bless you. You know, like James says, you know, someone comes starving and you say, well, be blessed. Go in peace. And they go home and starve to death. You know, placebos are not very nourishing. And I think, I hope at least, that I listen a bit more effectively and try to enter into the skin of people. That's what I think it means to be a Christian. Third, I had to reanalyze emotions when it comes to place. The first years I traveled, I spoke. At Holden, Marge was invited. I'm just an addendum. She just resurrected me for the night. So tonight you'll hear me, and then I'll say, good night. That's kind of neat. But you got to rethink what it means to be a wife if the man is always number one. Kind of tragic. Many women are gifted more than men. Intellectually, I suppose, academically, I've discovered women are normally higher on the totem pole when it comes to academic prowess. Maybe that's the fact that they got to prove themselves some way. They can't so much with muscle in most instances, so maybe that's how that's done. But fourth, I discovered praise. My favorite section was the Living Bible 34th Psalm when I was hospitalized. For some reason, it kind of engraved itself in my psyche. It starts, "I will praise the Lord no matter what happens. I will constantly speak of his glories and grace." And I hurt so. I felt I hurt like the crucified. Every minute, 24 hours a day, and I was in sheer ecstasy. And that wasn't me. I was just flesh and blood like anybody else. But the prayers of the saints lifted me. Invisible hands. We got 3,500 letters. Roman churches had prayers for us, especially for me. I felt lifted by invisible hands. I knew I was in the presence. And I began to praise. And this was my heart song. And I could lay there and weep so that the salt burned my eyes. I had to call for the nurse to wipe them out. But I learned to praise. So first thing I wake in the morning, I thank him. I will praise the Lord no matter what happens. I will constantly speak of his glories and grace. I will speak of all of his kindnesses toward me. Let all who are hurt or offended take heart. Taste the Lord and see how kind he is. I think that's magnificent. So that Bible says, Old Testament, the Lord is enthroned on the praises of Israel. Isn't that beautiful? If you blow a balloon in the sky and you keep blowing it and it hangs there, God hangs in space when we praise him. That is an amazing statement. That's his throne room. And that's why Brother Carl, the man with the fastidious fingers, said this afternoon or this morning that to be orthodox means that you're straight in your praise. That's beautiful.
One thing that the accident gave us was time. Because Erling was busy all the time and gone a lot, and I was busy with the children and had made a life of my own, writing films and film scripts and counseling series and all sorts of things. We just never had time for one another. But the gift we got from the accident that helped us through that time of change was time to communicate, time to talk. I had a captive audience. He was totally paralyzed
Ocean
from the neck
reject.
Down. And there he was, and we had to talk. And we had precious moments together when we were able to talk at last about how we felt about our life together and what we were going to do from now on. You see, most of us, the changes are so gradual that we never take time to deal with them or talk about them. For us, we had to talk about them, and that was a great gift. And we could make a dramatic change in our life, become, as Erling said, almost new people born again in that ocean that afternoon when we struggled with death. And we had time to reflect on it. Mm-hmm. There's an action reflection model, and most of us are caught up in the action and never get time for the reflection. But we did talk, and we learned through that to communicate in intimate ways. We're not afraid of fighting anymore. And Erling, I think, while he still has a tendency to flight, and I have a tendency to fight, because I grew up on the streets of Chicago and my mother sent me off to work at 16 with a pair of brass knuckles in one pocket and a package of pepper in the other pocket to protect me from the Chicago gangsters of that day. But so that Erling has finally learned that it isn't going to kill our marriage if we talk about the things that bug us. And most people who say to me, "We never fight," reveal to me that they don't dare to fight. Because if they did, they'd have no idea what would happen. They don't know how far they might go if they got in touch with their real feelings. And I used to be afraid of that. if I really expressed to Erling my resentment over the fact that he was never home and never with the kids and never with me, I was afraid where it would lead me. Would it destroy our marriage? Would we divorce? What would happen? And we don't fear that anymore. And part of that is we have accepted each other finally as equals. We don't worry about authority at all anymore, because we believe that true intimacy can only exist where there's equal authority that shifts as the health of a partner, the circumstances, the strength of the partner, the gifts of the partner for that period in history are called forth. And so leadership can shift from Erling to me. As he said, you know, this week he has to adopt the role of spouse. Other times I am spouse. And the leadership shifts back and forth. Sometimes he feels so rotten in the daytime that he has to depend totally on me to pick him up. Sometimes I come home from extended trips as in the consulting role so worn out that I just say, you know, I need a lot of stroking today, and don't expect me to be strong at all. And we can say that to each other, and it's not going to destroy a relationship. We have learned that we can hang on to each other, and we can hold hands, and we know we're not going to let go, and we can struggle until we get it out of our system. And we have learned to fight with each other, and we have learned to confess and forgive. And it was very hard for both Erling and me before the accident to say, I'm sorry, and to say, I forgive. In fact, that day on the beach, we actually had not been talking for 3 days. Erling had gone into one of his sulks. That was his way of dealing with me when I became unhappy about something. And as a result, I felt hurt and would withdraw. And then we would, you know, Christians usually don't fight by arguing out loud. They just don't talk. And so for 3 days, we had communicated through the children. You know, tell your mother that I'm going down to the beach to swim. And I'd say, well, tell your father to be back by 6 for dinner. And that had gone on. And at that time, you know, the bed can feel 15 feet wide. And you long for intimacy again. You want to reach out. You hope that the other person is reaching out to you. But you know very well if he touched you, you'd say, leave me alone, you know, and you'd have to go away. And so this went on. And that day on the beach, we still had not been talking. We still hadn't made up, because we didn't know how to really talk about our feelings or really fight fair, as the saying goes. So we got down to the beach, and we were lying on the blanket, and my friend was there also. And without a word, of course, Erling got up, and we used to do this together, started running down the beach toward Scotsman's Cove, the other direction. And when I saw him go, I knew that day, and the Spirit spoke to me and said, don't let him go without making up. And so I got up and I said to my friend, I'm going to run with Erling. So I ran after him, and I called out above the wind, do you want somebody to run with? And he turned around, and he saw me and reached out his hand. And of course, being younger than he is, I ran faster. And I caught up to him. And we ran down the beach together and walked back and made plans for that evening. We were going to go to dinner together, to a movie without the children, and get close to one another again. The evening never came. But God gave us a chance, another chance. And you know, I've read Our Town again, and I remember Emily going back on her 12th birthday after her death, and how she finally begs the stage manager to take her back to her grave because the pain of remembering all that she had there in life and how little they appreciated it was too much for her, and she couldn't bear the memory anymore. God gave us a second chance. And I guess Erling and I would have to conclude tonight by saying that we hope you don't have to break your neck to start talking about the changes that are occurring in your life. Now, if you have any questions or comments.
She'll answer them. It's her night. I have to say yes. Not much, but it's shadowed. I caught myself saying we're both going to speak. Luckily, I got resurrected tonight. But sure, you have to fight it through. Just like I'm sure she did in the past when sometimes I'm sure that when I talked about something, she knew more about it than I. You know, and I'm sure you felt put down. So it's just good to get a role reversal so you understand and feel how people feel. But it's easier all the time. She travels now and gets to know thousands of people. We both speak around quite a bit, and a lot more this coming winter. But she gets around with relationships all the time with people that I don't have. And that's kind of neat, and that I am grateful for.
Yeah,
that was very hard on the children. And again, you know, what affects one member of the family affects the whole family, especially those involved in the moment. And for the two children who were closely involved, the 19-year-old girl and the 14-year-old boy, both of them needed a lot of counseling afterwards at various times because the trauma of seeing someone who had always been totally strong in their eyes. And there I confess that I, as a mother, really did damage to my children's perception of their father, because like so many of us who have feelings of resentment and anger, we compensate for them by projecting something else. And so I would tell the children, protect Erling. I should have let them say to him at times in their life, mm-hmm. Dad, I get angry with you when you won't stay home, or when you leave what you promised to do with me, go to the Little League game or something, because somebody calls you out to the hospital or something. And I should have, but I always protected him. Your father is busy with his work. He is doing the Lord's work. Mm-hmm. And, you know, all that pious garbage.
Small L.
And so I'd always held him up to the children as this strong person, you know, sort of godlike in dimensions, out there doing the Lord's work, kind of a mini God. And so our daughter expressed it afterwards. She said, I will never be the same again, because all my secure foundations in that moment, when I saw that my dad could be struck by a wave and be totally paralyzed, then there was no security anymore. So she had to quit college because it was too traumatic for her to go back and even compete in the testing program. And she was out of school then for a couple of years working. She finally did finish college, but it was with a great deal of need for support. And the 14-year-old did very well academically, but even today he has some phobias that bother him that he has to deal with, like he doesn't like to fly in planes, and I suppose some claustrophobia because he thinks of that watery grave that his father almost had. Christy had nightmares for at least 3 to 6 months afterwards where she would wake up screaming because she had the recurring dream that she had lost Erling's body and couldn't find him in the ocean. So it really affected.
She almost did.
And she almost did. That's the wave came, a powerful wave came and took him out of her arms, and then she almost went under herself trying to get him. So, yes, it did affect them very much. And our granddaughter, who was with us then and was 6 years old at the time, like adults often do, we forget to deal with the feelings and the perceptions of children. They get whisked away, and they're told, you know, Grandpa broke his neck. So when Erling was finally able to be strapped in a wheelchair at the hospital and receive visitors in a little waiting room outside of ICU, our granddaughter was brought there by our son and daughter, and she, when she heard the wheelchair coming down the hall, her father was pushing his wheelchair, and I was in the waiting room, all of a sudden she got up, ran into a corner, hid her face in her hands, and just would not come out of the corner as long as he was there. And then she, when he left, I went over to get her, and she said, "Is he gone?" And I said, "Yes." And she said, "Is his head back on?" And what to her did a broken neck mean? Like a doll with a broken neck. His head was off. And here for all those months, she had suffered with that image of her grandfather. So I think it's important to realize, yes, they were affected. Well, I hope that our story of the changes that came to us and how we coped with them will help you. Main thing is talk about it.